All right, so tonight you will have hopefully received a little course schedule. Do you have that in front of you?
Yes.
Why don't you take a look at that and keep it in your binder, maybe in the front flap, so as we go you can kind of know where we're at and where we're going. And right now you can probably see that we are at the third week, and we are looking at skepticism for the second time, sensory skepticism with foundationalism and realism training. So there's going to be a little bit of more focus on that. But then you could see next week we're going to kind of switch topics and get into something else. Now, these topics will overlap. So just because we're moving into a different thing, if you did not get something in the last class, don't worry, we're going to revisit it again, in a different form, in a different time period, if you will, in the history of philosophy, and in different ways we meet that philosophy and culture. So empiricism will come next, and logical positivism, and down the line. Now, you can see that the end of the class is like light years away in June. So we don't mess around here. You know that semester thing in college? No, We do the half-year thing here. So I just want to encourage you that, like I mentioned at the beginning of the course, this is the beginning, hopefully, for you of a lifelong journey. And some of these classes here at this Bible college go for a year or two. And some people have, like, perfect attendance. So just kind of think of it as part of your lifestyle, okay? It's like a cult you're joining, okay? Sound good? Just show up and you don't know why. You're going, you just go. And you get brainwashed on during the time you're there. On a real note, though, that it is a long-term commitment, and we recognize that. So only the strong will survive. And I just really hope that you will just embrace this as something that you will take in as part of your life, because you want to change your life, you want to change your Christian walk, you want to think about God differently, and you want to show people God in a different way. Maybe the ways you've been doing it in the past haven't been working, and this will give you that pre-evangelistic technique that you've been looking for. All right, so last week we talked about methodological skepticism. Does anybody remember anything about last week? Did you even exist last week? Let's try this. I'm gonna ask you some questions to refresh your memory, let you think about it and answer, okay? So a little pop quiz here. So what is the definition of rationalism? Without looking at your notes. Come on. Rationalism. Who can give me some sort of a definition? It may not be perfect. Uh-huh.
Just one, two, three.
Okay.
Okay, the first thing is criteria.
Okay, yeah, that's good. Good, good. It is criteria.
Criteria.
Yeah. Yes. Remember the arrows across the screen here? Well, that's part of it. That's part of it. I'm looking for a definition, though. That's more of a flow. That's actually an answer to another question coming up. Okay, rationalism asserts that the knowledge is obtained only through the reason of the mind. So we can only have knowledge through reason of the mind. Do you remember that? This was kind of what Descartes was advocating. What's the difference between strong and weak skepticism? I like it. I like it. You're halfway there. So the weak would be, we don't have knowledge until we know it with 100% certainty. The strong would be, we can have no knowledge whatsoever about the external world at all. How about, what was Descartes' goal with his skepticism?
To avoid the draft.
To avoid the draft. Okay.
Okay. Did he make it a so I am?
I think therefore I am.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. He was trying to say that there is a different, the mind was separate from the body. He was trying to relieve the mind from being sucked into the mechanistic, deterministic machine of the material universe that other philosophers were talking about. Okay, what is the famous phrase that he arrived at in Latin? What is it? Cogito ergo sum, you cheated, sir. Thanks for cheating in Latin. What does the word epistemology mean? This is like Trivial Pursuit. Without looking at your notes. Yes, very good. The study of how we acquire knowledge, how we know things. Excellent. I'm going to say that again in a second. What is the epistemology of the typical skeptic? Good, excellent. Good job. You finally were able to. Okay, what is the difference between a hard agnostic and a soft agnostic? It has nothing to do with their muscles. Okay, go ahead and look. The other one was, you're halfway there again. The other one was, I can't know God. I can't know God. The other one is, I don't know if God exists. There's a big difference. So we just kind of say they're both agnostic. One's a hard agnostic, one's a soft agnostic. Okay, very good. What are the categories for knowledge for the skeptic? Remember we had one here, and then one was over here. One was like off.
Unknown.
Wait, say it again.
True, false, unknown.
True, false, unknown. Very good. Excellent. Good job. What are some of the criticisms? Now you can look at your notes. What are some of the criticisms of methodological skepticism? We went through about 5, 6, 7, 8. What are some of the criticisms of methodological skepticism? There's an infinite regress problem that they face of how to justify the initial criteria with this frame of thinking. What else?
Their standard is too high.
Yes. That's right. They have this standard for certainty that's beyond belief. It's something we just can't adopt for any academic discipline. What else? I mean, they're right there. You could just spew them out.
They fail their own criteria. So they fail their own method.
That's right. Yeah, they can't. It doesn't live up to their own method, their own standard. So it's self-refuting. They have a self-contradicting philosophy. Good. What else? Is this bringing back to mind some things as we go through this? People are like, I don't even know what I ate for dinner last night. All right, so how about a couple more? What are some other criticisms of methodological skepticism? Come on, they're right there. Somebody say something. Yes. Yes, yes, that's good. We mentioned that one. So how about it tears down too much? Tears down too much. It tears down everything. It doesn't build up anything. There's no philosophy that you can build off of skepticism to know anything, know the world. So it's kind of useless in that sense. Was there another comment? Okay, let's hold it there. So, little pop quiz, yes, ma'am. Okay, that one should be on. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay, good. So I will do this one now. All right, thanks. Okay, so tonight what we're going to do is we're going to look at another type of skepticism first. We're going to look at some popular sayings, and we're going to look at how to understand these sayings, and then the implication of this sort of thinking, and then we're going to show the criticisms for that. And then we're going to do it again with another type of skepticism coming from a certain skeptic that's very famous in history. And then lastly, we're going to look at some responses in general by doing a kind of a mini little lesson on foundationalism and realism. And if there's still time, we're going to look at the burden of persuasion, the burden of proof, the coherence theory of truth, and the correspondence theory of truth. So we'll just play it by ear as we go here. Now, last class we let out a little late, so hopefully we'll try to be under the 8:45 deadline tonight. We'll see how it goes. I wanted to mention that a few things that we're going to talk about tonight may not be so relevant to what you will hear on the street. So we'll go through this, but you may think, I don't know if I've ever heard anybody say that, you know. But what I'm trying to do with some of this is not so much give you a way to respond to little quick witty remarks you hear out there, but I'm trying to educate you and give you a Christian-based philosophical framework so that you can have a way to think apologetically in all sorts of situations. Because like I mentioned during the first class, if you learn a witty response or a remark and give that, you'll forget it a week later. What we're trying to do is give ourselves a structural system, a way to think about things that is so solid that you'll be able to stand up in any conversation and vocalize. So just work with me and give me patience as we go through some of this material, because I'm trying to set you up. I'm kind of doing some things on purpose by introducing you to some of these pieces of skepticism initially. If you open up a lot of philosophy textbooks that try to give you a foundation for, say, an intro to a philosophy class, if it's a good textbook, it will start with epistemology. And that's what we're doing. I'm kind of tricking you. And now I'm telling you I'm tricking you. The idea here is that I'm starting with skepticism for a reason. I'm trying to get you to think about things a certain way initially so that you can then build up a system of knowledge from that, kind of like what we saw Descartes doing last week, right? He used doubting to break down ideas to arrive at a certain foundation. The certain foundation is what he was looking for so that he can rebuild all of philosophy from that, okay? So just recognize that tonight is going to be one of those classes where you may think, well, this isn't that practical. Well, don't worry. We're going to meet some of these ideas throughout this course, and I'm going to just continue to give you kind of, if you think of it this way, like you go to a trainer at 24-hour fitness or something, they may have you doing some stretchy pulley things and weird exercises with the ball, you know, maybe initially to start there to get some base muscles, and then eventually you're going to be pounding the weights in the big boy weight room with all these freaky guys on steroids, you know. So that's kind of the idea, is that we're getting base muscles now so that later on we could work out on the free weights. Yeah, exactly, exactly. It's like, what the heck? Why am I waxing things? Right, exactly. Thank you for that. So, yes, sir?
I saw that.
You've seen that movie? Okay. That was not one of the quiz questions, but... okay, now, tomorrow... believe it or not, apologetics.com, the team I'm with, is putting on a conference in San Diego. If you at all are interested in going to down there, it's a Friday night, pretty much all day Saturday conference, and it's called In the World But Not of the World. And we're bringing in some pretty top-notch theologian to speak, and some of our guys. I'll be doing a talk as well. And so that's kind of fun. They've been pushing me to announce that in different ways. So just FYI, you're invited to a conference in San Diego tomorrow night. No, there won't. Yeah, pretty much morning till late afternoon, I guess, full day. It's in San Diego. If you go to the website, I think it's La Mesa or Mesa or something. If you go to apologetics.com, there's a big banner right there. Okay. And another thing I want to tell you about is that last year's science class, did I mention this already? We're getting it put into a book. So in the next year or so, there'll be a book available from last year's class. So if you don't want to come to those classes when we do it again, you could read the book. So that should be kind of fun. And my hope is that it's not that we need another apologetics book, but there's no book out there that summarizes all of the material available on intelligent design and criticisms of macroevolution and abiogenesis and things like that. So this book will give someone a kind of introduction into scientific apologetics as it stands now, and hoping to translate into other languages, because there's just nothing really available in other countries in apologetics, especially scientific apologetics. So be in prayer for that if you think about that. All right, how about we pray and get going here? Father, we thank you so much for the opportunity to come here tonight and open our minds to all that you have for us to learn. And we ask that you would guide our hearts, guide our minds, to help us be effective witnesses for your name. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so you may have heard things like this. There's two that I'm going to give you, and tell me what you find in common. In the cases of miracle stories in the Bible, all they could do is trust their senses. But senses often fail and are unreliable. Okay, now what about this? We can never know for sure if we see a miracle, as we can't always trust our senses. What do you find in common there? The word senses is in them. What about senses? Can't trust them. We can't trust our senses. Now, again, you may not have heard this on the street, but we're getting somewhere with this. If we can't trust our senses, what's going to happen to certain Christian doctrines? We'll look at that in a sec. So this idea of we can't trust our senses is rooted in a philosophy known as skepticism. Different type of skepticism we saw last week, but similar. So this skepticism attacks key Christian doctrines. Miracles, including the resurrection of Jesus, are basically attacked with this type of thinking. So the first thing then we would then ask is, are miracles possible? And this is something that we'll cover next week, and we will also discuss a bunch of other things in our naturalism, materialism, physicalism class next week. So that's a first question. Are miracles even possible when we start thinking about miracles, according to a skeptic? Should we believe other reports of miracles? So we'll cover this probably on the last week of the course when we look at the miracles argument. You'll see in your schedule there. Should we believe other reports of miracles, or reports from others regarding miracles? And then the third thing is, could we be mistaken in experiencing a miracle ourselves? Could we be mistaken in experiencing a miracle ourselves? Another thing that's not there is another two Christian doctrines are general revelation and special revelation. Who here can tell me what general revelation is? Yes? Special revelation. Right. So we're going to look at general revelation and special revelation more towards the end. But that's basically the idea. Is general revelation is when we look at the world and experience the world and see the world, we use our senses, right? If our senses deceive us, or if they can be mistaken, then how do we know the external world is appearing to us accurately? How do we know we're experiencing the external world accurately? With special revelation, say in the case of Scripture, which and the incarnate Son of God, these are the forms of special revelation given to us by God, and how he's revealed himself in a special way through these two forms, then we may not have experienced Jesus properly when he was with us, because our senses may have deceived us. He could have been a ghost the whole time. He could have been a hallucination the whole time, especially after the resurrection. And with currently, when we think we experience a miracle, let's say, or a vision of Jesus, or an angel of some sort, in these cases where we are experiencing God in a very unique, special way, we could be deceived. Our senses could be misleading us. We may not be experiencing reality accurately. That's kind of the idea with this type of skepticism. So if it is true that we can't trust our senses in extraordinary circumstances, then how do we know miracles are possible? That we know if a miracle occurred? How do we know that we can know God through nature? And how do we know that if God reveals himself to us in a special way, how do we know that we can experience that accurately if our senses could be mistaken? So this skepticism gets us to core questions that we ought to ask ourselves. And these are epistemological questions. Epistemology is, again, the study of knowledge, or how we acquire knowledge. So I want you to do something for me right now. I want you to stand up. Okay, we're going to have a little interaction. So that was hopefully a fun little experience on how to be philosophical with each other. So does anybody think they have a really good answer to the first question? How do we know things? How do we know anything at all? Yes, sir. Okay, very good. Nice. We perceive them from our senses. Okay. It does. So if you say that the external world could be known, that is a presupposition, and then you go out and try to know it, right? Yeah. What else? Any other good ideas here?
Special revelation. Senses as well as outside beyond senses.
Yeah. Special revelation. Yes, very good. Special revelation, something independent of our sense experience. That's another way to know. Very good. What about this second question? How do we separate what's true and what's false? How do we distinguish between the two?
Through test and analysis.
What type of test and analysis? Sense testing. Yeah. So you observe something being as it is tested. So again, that requires looking at it. So our eyes. How else do we separate what is true from what is false? Experience, okay.
Again, same as special revelation.
Okay. Oh, that's a good idea, yeah. So, yeah, the number of people that experience the same thing. Yeah, multitude of witnesses, right? Very good. So if you look here at this list of questions, number one, how do we know things? Two, how do we know anything at all? How do we acquire knowledge? Are our methods for acquiring knowledge justified and warranted? What counts as knowledge? What is something that we say is knowledge, and what is something we say that is not knowledge? how do we separate truth from falsity? What epistemology is the right one? Okay? So what we're doing here is we're looking at skepticism because it's kind of giving us a pathway or a roadway into skepticism or into epistemology. And so the idea is that we want to find out what epistemology is the right one. What is the epistemology we should have as Christians? What epistemology do we recommend to others? All right, so we have to know first what is epistemology, and we have to figure out what is a good one. And the good one will answer these above questions accurately and appropriately. So we're going to get to that kind of at the end. So now, back to skepticism, back to sensory skepticism. Now, sensory skepticism and the argument from error go something like this. This skepticism comes from rationalism, which states that empirical knowledge is subject to error and isn't reliable. So we learned last week that rationalism is the way we know things through reason alone. The idea with that is also that anything that we can gain through sense experience should be doubted, because our senses are not reliable. So rationalism really emphasizes what we can know through just pure thinking, and it kind of is skeptical on things that we know through experience, or our five senses. So there have been times when my five senses have deceived me, where something I thought was the case turned out to be not the case. For example, have you ever been in a canoe, and you've been rowing a boat? Have you ever done this? And you've looked into the water, and you've seen the oar be bent as it enters the water. The sunlight's on the water, you can see into the water a bit, and the oar is bent as it enters the water. You pull it out, and the oar is straight. You put it back in, the oar's bent. What is going on? Is the oar bent or straight? Light refraction. So what is happening here? To us, the oar is appearing bently, okay? Well, philosophers, this is how they say things. The oar appears to us bently. And but the idea here is our senses are deceiving us. What about this? Have you ever been walking around when you're a kid, just getting into trouble, and you wander upon some railroad tracks, and you look off into the distance, the tracks appear to be converging to a single point down the way, don't they? What is happening there? There's something going on that we're perceiving that's not really happening. The tracks actually don't cross or don't meet. They continue to be parallel. So to us, that's how they appear. They appear like they're meeting, but in reality, they don't. So again, our senses are deceiving us. In these cases, I confuse sense data with how the world actually is. I could be mistaken about everything I am sensing right now. I could be mistaken that there's a room full of students. I could be mistaken that I'm in some church multipurpose room. It's possible that I could be mistaken about that. I could be in some hospital ward somewhere, having a dream. In fact, I could have made mistakes about all of what my senses have informed me about up until this point in time. All of my knowledge in my entire life that has been derived from sense data, I could be mistaken about. So I have to throw away all that knowledge. So the idea here, or the question we're asking, is how can I claim to have knowledge if my senses are unreliable and can't be trusted to report things accurately? So one philosopher puts it like this: we do not know the external world because we cannot trust our senses, since they have deceived us in the past. So again, I can't trust my senses to report accurate information of the external world. This is just, it's an idea that is being tossed around because the skeptic is trying to find a way where they can attack what we believe. And they do this about attacking the external world. So what follows is, if I can't know anything about the external world, I can't know anything about God So again, here are the implications. We can't know anything about the external world, as our senses may be mistaken. We can't know if God exists, because just by the magnificence of nature, as our senses may be mistaken. We can't know if we ever have a vision of God or from God, as our senses may be mistaken. We can't trust the miracles in the Bible, as the Bible characters' senses may have deceived them. And we can't know if we can ever experience a miracle ourselves, or ever know we have experienced a miracle. Because we may think we have experienced a miracle, but in reality, our senses may be deceiving us. Now, when it comes to the miracle reports in the Bible, we're going to talk about this at the very end of the class. We're going to look into how do we trust miracle reports. So that's a different question than what this is getting at. The idea here is, if you were there and you saw a resurrected Jesus, is it possible that your senses could have deceived you? Is it possible that you could have been hallucinating when you thought you saw Jesus? When you were standing there and he was before you and he showed you the holes in his wrists, is it possible that he was a ghost and that you really just wanted him to be real again and resurrected because you missed him so much, because he was the hope for the world, because you were in a time of grieving? Is it possible that you were hallucinating in that experience? Yes, it is possible. Now, what happens is, in the biblical apologetics class, we go through all of these alternative explanations to the resurrection. And one of the most talked about explanations is that the disciples were hallucinating. They were in such grief and such emotional anguish that they could not experience a real resurrected Jesus. All they could experience was a projected resurrected Jesus, that he really wasn't there. He was still dead. So this is one of the top, and still is, one of the top alternative explanations to the resurrection. Now, like I mentioned before, you have to take the biblical apologetics class to find out what's up with that a little bit more. But there's some real significance to this, and for our purposes here tonight. How do we know they weren't deceived when they saw the resurrected Jesus? And by the way, the Christian faith, it kind of depends on that being actually true and that actually happening. So this is a big deal. If we can't trust what our senses are telling us, then the Christian faith is not really on solid ground. We really need Jesus to have risen bodily, not just spiritually and not just in our minds when we just project his resurrection. What about all the other miracle claims in the Bible? The parting of the Red Sea. There's some really significant, fascinating things that happened. All of those miracle reports, all of those biblical characters could have been mistaken. Their senses could have been deceiving themselves. This is what the skeptic says. This is one of the attacks they level. They level a lot of attacks, but this is one of them. So what are the criticisms of sensory skepticism? How do we respond? Well, the idea that we want to do is we want to just go head on with them, okay? So we say this. Number one, that our senses are typically reliable. Yes, it could be the case that we are being deceived right now. It could be the case that we're mistaken and our senses are failing us. But typically, they're not. So, one philosopher says this skepticism fails because from the fact that our senses sometimes deceive us, it does not follow that they always do. So, each situation is unique and requires unique judgment. And this is pretty straightforward, right? Nothing too profound here. You just evaluate each situation uniquely. And when you come across a situation, again, where you realize that you were deceived in the past, now you know, oh, I was deceived in the past. So now I know how to evaluate this unique situation now. Number two, doubting our senses requires us to know something. So if you read through this with me, to know that our senses sometimes deceive us requires us, or requires that they sometimes or often do not. Indeed, for us to discern that I mistakenly think that the oar is bent, that the wall is flat, that the tracks do not remain parallel, that the road is wet, or that the card is a red six of hearts, requires that we have clear and accurate sensory knowledge. It presupposes that we know accurately that the oar is in fact straight, that the wall is in fact curved, that the tracks are in fact parallel, that the road is in fact dry, and that the card is in fact a red six of spades. The argument of the sensory skeptic then requires as legitimate and true being knowledge from accurate sense data, what it purports to show is not legitimate and true. Therefore, it self-refutes. So the idea here is that even doubting our senses requires us to know that they were once reliable or know that they were once mistaken. And in order to know that, we have to have experienced them accurately in the past. So the idea with that is very straightforward. Don't let the long quote distract you. But the other thing that we could say is that otherwise our doubts are unreasonable. And that which is unreasonable ought to be rejected, if you remember how we started off this class. So any questions on that before we go into this third response here? Cards. He's just saying that he picks up a card. It could be this, but it's really that in reality. He's just saying it's a way to be deserved. Well, one of the things I mentioned before is that when you come, this class does not come from a presuppositionalist perspective. So I just throw that out and say, no, we're doing a classical evidentialist apologetics here. So by saying that, I don't care if they're never going to convert or if they're eventually going to convert or what the Holy Spirit is doing in their life. If they have an intellectual stumbling block to coming to the faith, I'm going to help them. I'm going to love them by addressing that stumbling block. And a practical example could be, I think, say I'm in a, I've been burned by the church and all Christians just suck, you know. And the church stole money from me, let's just say. And then I go and I live my life and years later some Christians are really nice to me and are really generous to me in my time of need. You know, here's a way that Christians have loved them back and helped bring down those walls that they had, the emotional animosity. That's all we're doing here with the evidentialist classical approach. We're just saying, here's some things that you can think about to not have that wall anymore. Your wall is unnecessary. And the skepticism, like you said, could be a smokescreen. It oftentimes is. And so are all these other walls that they put up. But we address them one by one because we have the answers. We have good answers. And they're amazing to think about and talk about because it's the truth. And what happens, the truth sets free. So that's kind of the idea with the classical evidentialist approach. We can talk about that more another time. It's a little bit off topic. But here with the second point is that doubting our senses requires us to know something. And if we know something, then we can't adopt complete skepticism. Okay? So if we doubt our senses, it first presupposes that we know them to be true and to be effective and reliable. Third, senses are innocent until proven guilty. Okay, read this with me, please. The senses are innocent until proven guilty. It is reasonable, then, to go with what our senses tell us about the world, as long as we have no overriding reason to doubt them, and as long as we're careful. So, our senses are innocent until proven guilty. So we go with our senses until we have a reason to doubt them. If we don't have a reason to doubt our senses, then we go with them. So J.P. Moreland puts it this way. One's current sensory beliefs are prima facie justified. I always get screwed up there. Justified, that is, innocent until proven guilty. So in this absence of defeaters, which are factors that refute or undercut one's justification, one has the right to be sure of one's sensory belief. So in the absence of what's called a defeater in philosophy, you have a right to go with what your senses are telling you. You are justified from the get-go to believe that your senses are reporting things accurately. So since we have no reason to doubt our senses and we have no defeater to our senses, we are justified in what we are experiencing through past and current experiences. So this is very straightforward. It's not meant to be too confusing here, but we're just taking the skeptic's criticism head on and say, no, that is not the case. I can trust my senses, and until I have a good reason to doubt them, they are reliable, and they're reporting the world to me accurately. Now, again, this sounds like, okay, well, pretty cool to me. I trust my senses all the time. You know? We're laying the foundation here, okay? Now, does anybody have any questions on that? All right. Yeah. Well, do you have a good reason to doubt my senses? And that's fine that you do, because I don't. And I'm not saying you, but I'm just saying to play along here. And this is what the skeptic attempts to do. Well, the disciples may not have doubted themselves, but I do, because I'm looking at this from an objective perspective, and I know that when people die, other people grieve. And the grievers oftentimes have dreams and whatnot that they have to work through. But what is really the case? Is it possible that the disciples were not deceived, that they were not mistaken? Yes, definitely possible. If they knew Jesus pretty well. When Jesus starts eating food and the fish is not disappearing into midair, you know, this is pretty hard empirical sense data that they're there. When he touches Jesus, when Thomas is touching Jesus, it's pretty hardcore sense data that he's there. So we have some pretty good evidence that they weren't just hallucinating. But again, we can get into that in detail. Yes, sir.
Maybe I'm getting off track, but there's just too much evidence. There's a road to Emmaus. There's a 500. There's a transfiguration.
Yeah.
Later on, there's the Essenes. There's Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls. How can you just say, oh, none of that really existed?
Yeah. You're right. It's mind-boggling when you start adding up the pieces of evidence and you create this cumulative case for the resurrection being a bodily resurrection. You're right. I mean, it's just unreal that people doubt this. But if you go to other miracle stories when it's just like a one-on-one sort of thing, or maybe you've heard this, or maybe you have had a miracle in your life, or you experienced one, and you tell other people about it, you know, they may say, well, you're probably just mistaken, you know. But, yeah, what we're trying to do is say, what about our epistemology? What is the right epistemology for us to hold? So if they put themselves in your shoes and say, okay, what if I had a miracle happen to me? Could I be mistaken about that miracle because my senses could be deceiving me? So we would ask them that. Say, please put yourself in my shoes and tell me, would you doubt your senses in this situation? You know, it's the middle of the day, broad daylight, I see a miracle right in front of me. Why should I doubt my senses? Why should you doubt your senses in that situation? Other questions?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Absolutely. That's a great point. Again, that adds to the other evidence. And this is so fun to talk about when you start talking about the resurrection, because I honestly think the resurrection is not only the fulcrum of our faith, but it is very intriguing. It's probably one of the most intriguing things to study from a theological perspective. To just a historical perspective. I mean, every way you look at the resurrection, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. So, I hear you. That's one of the criticisms that is brought up, is that after 20 years, the Jesus resurrection thing, the report of the empty tomb, became he resurrected in their minds because it was 20 years later and they had nothing else to do. You know, this is one of the criticisms. We have responses for that. Now, I don't want you to start doubting the resurrection based on what Phil just brought up, because I don't want to give you the response right now. I don't want to get into that too much more, but I like that we already have a little bit of basic knowledge here in biblical historical apologetics. That's really good. Yeah. You guys are loving this topic, I can tell. This is very good. Absolutely, yeah. It's like, why should we doubt what they experience? Why should we doubt that their senses weren't reporting things accurately? Yes, sir. Could be. Yeah, you could draw a different conclusion from the same evidence.
The same, yeah, and on the basis of how long that evidence has been available. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure where you're going with that.
Based on perception and small evidence.
Okay, this is really good. As far as the pyramids go, the aliens obviously built the pyramids. That's very clear. Everyone knows that. I mean, just watch the Discovery Channel. I like the exchange here. I'm going to have us take a break instead of continue work with that because we're at our break. So why don't we get up and be friendly for about 5 minutes, talk to some, make some friends. I think there's some ice cream sandwiches in the freezer, maybe. I brought them last week. I forgot to tell you. Unless some little kids ate them, they should be in there. So we'll be back in 5 minutes. All right. Now, we're going to get going here on the second half and see how much time we have left for some other things. So you may hear things like, everything we know by experience. Okay? Everything we know by experience. So we don't know anything that's not something we've experienced. Or how about this? We will never know if we have a soul because we will never experience it. So that is interesting. We will never know if we have a soul because we've never experienced it. Now the soul, you think, is something that experiences. But if you can't experience the soul, then according to this line of thinking, you can't know if you have a soul. So how should we understand these sayings and respond? Well, this skepticism, it comes from one of the most famous skeptics of all. Have you ever heard of a guy named David Hume? Yeah. All right. David Hume has nothing to do with Hume Lake, if you're a Christian camper. Now, British philosopher, he was a British philosopher who was very comprehensive in what he took on in his philosophy. He talked about a lot of stuff. He was very much a man of the Enlightenment era. His philosophy is so powerful, it continues to influence academic philosophy and people on the street to this day. So when we talk about skepticism, we're usually talking about ideas that come from Descartes or Hume. Descartes' skepticism of the senses and Hume's skepticism of rationality and reason. So Hume was a complete and consistent skeptic. He was skeptical about everything. And one of the main things was rationalism, the idea, again, that knowledge is acquired through reason that is independent of experience. So Hume was very skeptical about that. He thought that knowledge only comes through the senses. So this is kind of the opposite of the thing that we were talking about the first half, where we doubt our senses. In this case, Hume says, no, our senses are the only things that give us an accurate reflection of reality. So Hume attacked rationalism in that sense with philosophical skepticism. Now, skepticism for Descartes was to get at the foundation of knowledge. He wanted to have certain knowledge so he can build a superstructure on it. So he arrived at a certain foundation. I think, therefore, I am. But the skepticism for Hume was an end to itself. He wanted to finalize his philosophy with skepticism. He wanted his goal to be the validity of skepticism. It was a way of life for Hume. So Hume was skeptical about everything. Hume was so skeptical, to give you an example, he used to say things like, or think things like, we can't ever know a cause. We can't ever know a cause. All we can know are effects. The only thing we can experience with our five senses are effects. We never see a cause, we just see the effect of a cause. So he was very skeptical about that. Let's see, what else was he skeptical about? You know, it's interesting you say that, because there is a theory out there, and some people actually have thought this through, that Hume was influenced by Buddhism because of several different things. Hume was from Upper Scotland area, 1700s. So you think, well, how in the world could he have been influenced by Hume, by Buddhism? But they traced this missionary that went to Tibet, and they traced how he went there from Rome, but then also went up into the Upper British Isles area to do some further studying, and they think that they influenced each other in some way. And Hume also apparently went to France and at some time, so they think he encountered some Buddhist ideas in France too. Anyway, okay, Hume's empiricism is the root of his skepticism. Hume's empiricism is the root of his skepticism. So what is empiricism? We'll tell you in a second. Hume thought that knowledge is traceable to experience, that is, science, or sense experience, or sensation. So Hume thought that all I could know is that which my senses tell me. I can't know anything else except what I have experience of through my senses. So knowledge is traceable to my senses. This movement in philosophical thought is known as empiricism. And we'll go into detail about what empiricism is and why is it important and what are the criticisms of it. But for now, again, like I said, some of these things overlap. Empiricism asserts that all ideas or knowledge is attained through experience or the senses. There's a reason why I keep repeating this. I want you to remember it. Tasting, touching, smelling, seeing, hearing, these are our senses. It's sense data. We get a sound, that's from hearing, that's a sense data. One sound is one data. That sort of thing. For the typical empiricist, the mind is blank until it is filled with knowledge gained through experience in the world or scientific experiments. So in other words, when you're a baby, you're born, your mind is completely blank. It's a blank slate. You have no innate ideas, is what John Locke, the philosopher before Hume, thought. You have no innate ideas. You weren't born with any knowledge that was just automatic. You had to acquire knowledge as you went, and how you acquired it was through your senses. You didn't acquire it through reason. So there are no innate ideas. The internal knowledge we acquire as infants relies on sense data. So again, here you have, like last week, the mind separate from something, in this case, the actual world. So the actual world is outside of the mind, below the line, and the mind is a different thing altogether than the actual world. These things are separate. So what is between the mind and the actual world? What is between the mind and the actual world for Hume? It's our impressions, what Hume called impressions. So for Hume, the idea here is that here's our fun-loving Christian, okay? He's a super Christian, thinking about Jesus all the time. And then you have this wall, and then you have, say, a football, of course. So the idea is that Hume thought that the only way to know the reality is to see it, to taste it, to touch it, to smell it. That sort of thing. You can smell the leather. You can see the ball flying through the air. All that stuff. Super Bowl's this weekend, so you have to just kind of go with me if you're not into football, sorry. What is between the mind and the world? It's this line called impressions. It's a barrier, so to speak. You can't really experience the football in and of itself. You can't really experience objective reality itself. All you can experience is this line. This is appearing to you, but you only see this line of impressions. So whatever's out there, we can't really know. All we know is our impressions. So in our mind, we're getting all this sense data. It keeps coming constantly, rapidly. And he even talked about this, not having modern neuroscience at the time, that we're getting all these rapid sensations, one right after another, billions of them a second. It appears that reality is continuously doing things in front of us. But all we are getting is just a bunch of impressions here that inform our mind of things that are happening out there. But we never really know reality as it really is. We only know this impression. So we are inside our head. We're getting all this information, but we never really experience out there. Now, Hume was an empiricist, so he thought this is really the only way we know things, is through our impressions. is through sense data. No reason, no innate ideas, nothing. Just our impressions that feed us. So this kind of informs the mind. The impressions inform the mind, okay? So you can kind of draw this in your notes. And this is extremely important, all the stuff we're talking about, even though it seems a little weird tonight, because later on, when we talk about postmodernism, we're going to come back to this barrier between us and reality. And postmodernism is, if you didn't realize this, the cultural world we live in. So this is an extremely important idea. Empiricism, extremely important idea, that all we can know is through our senses. There's a lot of problems with this, as we'll see. I mean,
you know, even a blind dog can find the bone.
Yeah. If we start talking Helen Keller jokes, I mean, we are not going to heaven. I'll tell you that right now. That is one way to stay out of hell and heaven is to talk about Helen Keller. Anyway, but so this is really important. The skepticism stuff we're talking about, for many reasons. So as we're setting the foundation, So remember this, class, please, that all we can know is impressions, this wall between us and reality, okay? Now, yes, sir? Okay, see, now you're jumping even from postmodernism into New Age stuff. That's really good thinking, I like that. We'll go there like a month from now. Okay, very good. So... Yeah. There's a lot of things that you can relate to with this in our modern world. Yes. Oh yeah. Thank you very much. Hey, by the way, if you were here last week and you didn't put your name on this, can you check that you're here last week? Okay. The last thing on this is that when you are committed to impressions from sense experience, you get skepticism. Because if all I know are these, and I can never know this. Do you get that? So I'm always skeptical about the actual world because all I can know are my impressions. So this is the actual world out here. Okay. Now, so anything I write up here, hopefully you write in your notes. That's kind of the idea. Okay, so Hume's idea of ideas. Describing Hume's view, Jones says, a philosopher interpreting Hume, all simple ideas are memories, are memory copies of simple impressions. Complex ideas are combinations of simple ones. So for Hume, all ideas are copies of impressions. So the idea in the mind is just a photocopy of what's happening now here. It's as if he's looking and taking a snapshot with his Google glasses, if you will. And it's just kind of downloading the JPEG image to his mind, okay? That's the idea with Hume, is that he's taken a photocopy of the impression, and that's called an idea for Hume. So that's all our ideas are. All of our thoughts, they're just copies of impressions. We just have a lot of this data in our head floating around, and that's what he calls our thoughts. So all ideas can be traced to a precedent feeling or sentiment, an impression. It's just another way of saying that. Could be hearing, could be touch, yeah, good point. Those who disagree only need to try producing an idea derived, not derived from sense. So if you disagree with me, if I'm Hume, then try producing any idea. Try coming up with an idea that is not based on sense experience. Well, of course you can, because you just learned about rationalism last week, and reason and logic and things like that. That produces good ideas too. But for Hume, he says, no, those don't count. He's a pure empiricist. Let's see. More lively experiences are impressions. So if you have a really strong impression, that is a very lively experience, and that's a strong idea. All impressions, that is, all sensations, either outward or inward, are strong and vivid. So something is an impression if it's strong and vivid. If it's really weak, then we really don't even have an impression. So if I'm in a dark room and I just don't see things well, I don't have an impression, I don't have a thought. If I am in a loud room and I don't hear something distinctly, then I don't have an impression and I don't have a thought. Yeah, you'd be really confused. Ideas, impressions, perceptions, they're just sensations. So all of these ideas are just sensations. It's all it is. Everything in your mind, according to Hume, is just a bunch of impressions. There's no real mental activity. There's no real logic happening. There's no real reasoning. Reasoning is weak. It's discounted. Yeah, we're kind of like animals. Exactly. So the mind, for Hume, is just a collection of impressions. It's just this bin of impressions. That's all it is. It's like a container, a storage container. It's a hard drive. Yeah, in that sense. All we can know is our impressions from the actual world, like this. Okay, so the impression is what I know, not the object. So that's, for Hume, the idea here. Okay, this is the kind of skepticism Hume had. So for Hume, there is no mind. When Hume thinks about what a mind is, there is no mind. It's just this bin of ideas. Okay? We don't have a brain. We have a brain, we don't have a mind. So all I can know are what my perceptions tell me. One perception follows another. Pain and pleasure, grief and joy, passions and sensations succeed each other. And I never experience myself directly, only an impression of myself. So even when I do some self-reflection here, and I start to think about myself, I don't actually experience myself. I just experience an impression of myself. I just experience grief or joy. I just think about what I'm feeling right now, and I just feel anxious and weird and funky. I feel like, you know, I'm going to throw up, whatever. I mean, I'm only experiencing an impression of myself. I never actually experience myself. Kind of, yeah. It's a bit weird to think about. If you close your eyes and start to feel yourself, you don't feel yourself, you feel an impression of yourself, is what Hume says. What? Yeah. Well, the Matrix is very philosophical, so yeah. Oh, yeah, that was good, too. Well, this is what he's saying. He's saying, when I go experience things, I only experience the impression. I don't experience the thing itself. That's all he's saying. Let's keep moving here. I never experience myself directly, only impressions of myself. So this is Hume speaking here. When I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other. Then my perceptions are removed for any time, as by sound sleep, so long am I insensible of myself and may be truly said not to exist. So what he's saying is, when I go to sleep, I don't have impressions of myself, so I don't even know if I'm there. Well, then I'm having an impression of something. That's a good question. What am I having an impression of something? It's not real reality, it's just this alternative reality. So again, Hume would say, I'm having an impression of all alternative reality. I'm not experiencing alternative reality itself.
Did you have a subconscious negation?
Say what you mean by that. Okay.
His
previous senses inform the dream. It's psychological. It's subconscious, just throwing images out there. Well, you've experienced a world out there with colors and buildings and things, and that informs your dream. Yeah, you know about what it is to be stabbed because you've had an experience of being stabbed. Okay, let's continue. So he says, if I stop sensing myself, I don't know if I continue to exist. Pretty radical. We are just a bundle of perceptions. It's all we are, our soul, our mind, whatever we call ourselves. We're just a bundle of perceptions. We're just a storehouse of impressions. So he says, these perceptions succeed each other with inconceivable rapidity. and are in perpetual flux and movement. There is not simplicity at one time. There's not one single substance experiencing something. It's just a bunch of impressions coming into the same storehouse. It's the same bin. Let's keep moving here. We don't even know where these images are located. We can't just look in there and be like, oh, they're over here to the right side of our brain. We don't even know. We just are getting them. We don't know much about ourselves at all. We have no idea of the self because we have no continued impression of the self. So even if I was to look internally at myself, I would just get impressions, feelings, you know, emotions, that sort of thing. And then those go away. And then I get another emotion, you know, hours later, and then that goes away. So I don't even have continued emotions, so I don't even have a continuation of myself. So therefore, there is no mind to Hume. There is no mind to Hume. I'm sorry? Yeah. So what are the implications of Hume's skepticism? Well, number one, if anything about the external world is non-empirical, we can't know it. So everything about the external world that we know is something empirically derived. Empirically, again, from the five senses. If it's not empirical, we can't know it. This foreshadows what we're going to talk about later in empiricism and logical positivism and in postmodernism. We'll talk about those later. So we're just laying the foundation right now. The soul and God are empirically observable, according to Christians. We can experience God in the sense, like we can have visions of God, we can experience God through special revelation and general revelation. They are entities that we cannot have a repeated experience of to Hume, though. So we can't have knowledge of the soul or God. We can't say that we have a soul because we don't know if we have a soul because we don't have an impression of the soul. We can't say we know God exists because we don't have any experience empirically of God. He's not. We don't smell him, we don't see him. And if we had an experience of God or a miracle or something like that, special revelation, general revelation, our senses may be deceiving us. This is the idea with skepticism that we're encountering. Now, any questions on this before we get into some of the criticisms of this type of skepticism from Hume? Yes, sir. Your thoughts are impressions. You don't have a way to know your thinking.
Okay. Well, everyone else's thoughts are just
everyone else's?
Everyone else that don't have thoughts because you don't experience yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody else doesn't have thoughts either. Well, they have thoughts, but thoughts are just impressions. It's just information. Yeah. Like for me, my thoughts are impressions. For you, your thoughts are impressions. So that's what Hume defines as what a thought is. It's just a bunch of sense data. Yeah. Okay, so what are some criticisms of this? Well, let's go through this with me. Letter A there. Hume's skepticism fails to dismiss reality. So Hume is trying to dismiss reality, the soul and God especially. Criticism of Hume's skepticism regarding the self or the I. So let's look at this. Hume does not break free from the unified I. So we as Christians think that we have a soul. We think we have a mind. Most other people think at least they have a mind. And the mind is something that is unified. It's a simple substance that persists through time. It endures through time. It endures through change. Even though our body changes, our I does not. It continues. So the enduring eye through change is still required in the sense to reflect on the data of these fragmented impressions that Hume is getting. So you still have to have an eye there to house these impressions. There has to be something that endures through time, that does not change even though our body changes. If we are fragments of an eye, then we can't know the fragmented impressions. So if we're just this thing that comes into and out of existence all the time, back and forth, we really don't know if we have fragmented impressions. Jones puts it this way. In a word, if the self were only a flickering succession of loose and separate ideas, as the theory asserts, it could never know even the fragmentary world the theory describes. Such a self would be too fragmentary even to know its own fragmentariness, to make up a word. So if we're that fragmentary, we can't even know that we're fragmentary. In order to know the world that we are empirically experiencing, I must be contiguous through the experience to put the fragments of each experience together. So in order to know that there is an external world out there, we have to be a continuous self. So for Hume, this view just fails just because, in this sense, you have to have an enduring I to report the fact that you have these impressions. Now, Hume's skepticism develops despair. So this is interesting, and Hume admitted this despair. So Hume developed a bit of a despair, not just regarding his skepticism on the self, or the soul, or the mind, but his skepticism in general. Like I said, he was a skeptic that even there were causes out there. So Hume's views lead to a kind of a depressing pessimism about reality. Jones describes it this way: at times he was almost bewildered by the position in which he found himself and was at a loss as to how to proceed. So Hume's skepticism developed a bit of despair here. And Hume admitted this, that I am confounded with all these questions and begin to fancy myself in the most deplorable condition imaginable, environed with the deepest darkness. So he found himself in some sort of philosophical darkness. Hume referred to his reflection as philosophical melancholy and delirium. And he said that he tried to distract himself with other things, and then after 3 or 4 hours of amusement, I would return to these speculations, he says. They appear so cold and strained and ridiculous that I cannot find heart to enter into them any farther. I am ready to throw all my books and papers into the fire and resolve nevermore to renounce the pleasures of life for the sake of reasoning and philosophy. So essentially, he kind of was like, this philosophy is making me crazy. When I come back to it after I go distract myself and play backgammon or whatever, I get really bothered when I enter back into it and I'm ready to throw my books into the fire. And he had to go distract himself. He had to go amuse himself to kind of get out of this despair. So any philosophical pursuits that leads the originator of it into darkness and melancholy seems very suspect, doesn't it? There's something that seems very wrong with this if somebody is getting depressed by their own view. Okay, let's skip that last quote there. Any questions on Hume's sense of despair and depression that he got out of his skepticism? Yeah, in a sense it is, yeah. Yeah, you can see how depressing this would be if you just doubted everything, even the external world itself.
Did he ever have a successful relationship with a woman?
I doubt it.
But that's reality.
Yeah, he was a genius, though, so most geniuses don't. So, anyway. It does. It's very depressing. Yeah. So let's go to this part C here. Hume seemed to back off into kind of a mitigated skepticism. So at the end of the day, Hume kind of retracted some of his extreme skepticism. He basically came to the idea that we have to act and believe even with uncertain foundations. We have to pretend that the world is real and that we can know it so that we can act and believe in things like love, like you mentioned. We have to pretend that the world is knowable. And that our senses don't deceive us, and that our impressions reflect the world accurately. Essentially, this led to pragmatism. You may be familiar with that term, pragmatism. We'll discuss this later in the class as well. Again, this is just setting up a little bit of a foundation for later. Skepticism, in a word, is not a resting place. It's a propedeutic, if I'm saying that right, a beginning or a preliminary instruction. So that's kind of the idea with skepticism and how Hume kind of figured, okay, well, we'll just back off a little bit and let it be something that informs us on how to think well. So this is just seems like any other standard of inquiry to determine the truth as opposed to his extreme skepticism. So if you're a mitigated skeptic, you're just thinking critically about things. And there's nothing really wrong with that. I mean, we could all be skeptical initially. We could say, I'm not really sure. You know, have that attitude. That's okay, initially. It's a place to begin. So Hume thought that at the very least, a mitigated skepticism will help people keep away from metaphysical notions, abstract reasoning, and especially theology. So Hume was kind of someone who wanted to attack theology by attacking how we know the world, or how we acquire knowledge, epistemology. And then lastly here, in terms of criticisms, Hume's skepticism cannot be lived, to which he even admitted. Hume can't even live out his own skepticism, even if he wanted to. So he seemed to back off into a form of realism. Hume made comments like this that showed he was a realist in some ways. He said, "Nature will always maintain her rights and prevail in the end over any abstract reasoning whatsoever." So if I go and jump off a cliff, nature will win. Even though I may not know that I'm jumping off a cliff, I am jumping off a cliff. Realism is necessary to survive. You have to be a realist. And it turns out, at the end of the day, we're all realists, no matter what, Christian or non-Christian. Because if we're standing in front of a bus and it's quickly approaching us, we're all going to get out of the way no matter how skeptical we are. So if I'm an agnostic or an atheist and I claim to hold skepticism, when that bus is coming, I know there's a bus coming and I'm moving. So for Hume, it would have been like a horse and buggy. He would have got out of the way too. Even though to him, he's like, well, philosophically, I have no real reason to do this, but at a convention, I'm just going to get out of the way. No, Hume, you're a realist and you're getting out of the way so you don't get run over. So does Hume's skepticism stand up to scrutiny? No. And again, all of the above discussion is to set us up on these epistemological questions. How do we know things? How do we know anything at all? How do we acquire knowledge? Stuff we talked about in the first half when we were talking to each other. Are our methods for acquiring knowledge justified and warranted? What counts as knowledge? How do we separate truth from falsity? What epistemology is the right one for us to adopt, for anybody to adopt? So to help our friends out of their skepticism, we want to inform them and explain to them good epistemology. What is good epistemology? It's epistemology that reflects how we acquire knowledge in the actual world with actual people. So at the beginning, we were talking about, well, how do you get knowledge? What counts as knowledge? Some of us said things we know through our senses. That is one way. If you look around, we know things through our senses. Everybody seems to know that. So a good epistemology accounts for all the ways actual people know things. So what we're going to do here is we're going to talk about what a good epistemology is. What I did is I kind of brought in one thing from last week there that we never talked about. We'll skip it again tonight. Is to explain the benefits of skeptical inquiry versus skepticism. You can kind of get the idea there. And wonder and humility. This is something that Christians need to embrace, especially people dealing with apologetics. I can't tell you enough how important this is. And that's why I was admonishing you. Hopefully you got that email I sent last Saturday to really read that little outline, how does one do apologetics? Because in there, I really talk about the spirit of humility that is required here. We don't have it all together, folks. We don't know it all. As much as we think we do, we don't. Paul says, "For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." So we do have a lot of knowledge that we can access, but we don't know it all. And a lot of times, if you're going to continue this journey and make it a lifestyle for the rest of your life, it tends to be something that you can get prideful in. And this is why I'm encouraging this at the get-go, because we need to be mindful. And how we do this, how we study this, how we approach people in the street, it has to come from a spirit of humility. We have to adopt that. It's just part of this path and journey. It's to start with a sense of wonder and a sense of humility. There's a couple quotes there I gave you. Even though we don't know everything, we do know some things with certainty, and some knowledge we even have at 100%. Okay, so now if you go there to D, let's talk about our epistemology as Christians, and then we'll close out here in a couple minutes. Okay, so part D, we want to explain to our Christian and non-Christian friends, and even ourselves, explain this to ourselves, explain epistemological ways of knowing that are common to all peoples, okay? So we need to sometimes educate our friends, not in a belaboring way, but we want to do so lovingly. We want to inform them, hey, you know what? It's not just from your senses. You can get knowledge through other ways. Here's some ways. And that will help them establish something more along the lines of foundationalism, which is what we talked a little bit about last week. So the first thing is, yes, knowledge from empirical truths. So this is experiential knowledge, something called a posteriori, or a posteriori, after sense experience. So it's knowledge that is gained after sense experience. This is contingent, and it requires observation. We have to go around the world and look at things. We have to examine them. We have to observe them. This is how we get experiential knowledge, and this is essentially empirical knowledge. So I want you to familiarize yourself with the word empirical. Okay, so that's one way. The other way is knowledge from innate truths. Okay, this is another way we gain knowledge, Christians or non-Christians. It's common to all. Knowledge from innate truths. So innate knowledge is a priori, or a priori, another way to say it. A priori is logically prior to experience and independent of sense experience. So this is these innate ideas, like I talked about, when you're a baby and you're an infant, you have some innate ideas with you. You don't get these ideas from experience. They're things that you just have because it's common sense. These things philosophers call properly basic knowledge. We talked a little bit about this last week. Also referred to as first principles or simple seeing. Truths that are self-evident, if you recall. Things like 2 plus 2 is 4. Killing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong. The parts are less than the whole in the quantitative sense. Things that are just intuitive. You just know them because they're innate. You were kind of, in a sense, born with this knowledge. Not that you, as a baby you could think through this, but it's things that are independent of sense experience. You did not have to go look around the world to figure this out. The third way we know things is through reasoning. Okay, so here is where we get into the difference between inductive and deductive reasoning or logic. So inductively, we build a case based on indirect and direct evidence to conclude that the cause from the effects, conclude the cause from the effects, or conclude the general rule from the particular data. So in this sense, we build a case. We compile a list of evidence, if you will, and we present them. And as we go through evidence by evidence, the case that is built is stronger, and we have more certainty in saying yes or no to something, or true or false to something. So inductive builds a case from the bottom up. Now deductive is a little different. True premises are constructed to show the most logical conclusion. If the logic is valid and the premises are true, then the argument is sound. And one can be 100% certain. So this is very important. In studying the arguments for the existence of God, we are using oftentimes inductive and deductive logic. We build a case. This is just reasoning. This is just using logic. Okay, this is just another way we get knowledge. It takes a little bit of work sometimes to reason through things, to apply the laws of logic. We can arrive at solid conclusions inductively or deductively, either way. Again, a reasoning process. So this is another way we know things. Fourth, knowledge doesn't require complete certainty. So unlike Descartes, conclusions do not have to be 100% fail-proof for claims to knowledge. I can claim knowledge by induction and sense data, which is basically observation of cause and effects or any other empirical thing happening in front of me, even though I'm not 100% certain. So this is what culture tells us we cannot do with religious knowledge. So this is kind of something we got to tackle as we encounter that idea. But the point of this is that you don't have to have complete certainty to say that you know something. This is very important because Christians are getting beat up right here. We don't have to have complete 100% certainty to say we know something. Knowledge is justified true belief, if you remember that from last class. JTB, justified true belief. That is what knowledge is. It requires justification. It requires truth, and it's our belief that we have. If we have those things, then we can say we have knowledge. How do we get those things? Inductive arguments, reasoning, and empirical data, and innate ideas. And then this is where we could go into the burden of persuasion stuff. Like I mentioned, we would have time for it, but we don't because it's 9 o'clock. So even though I thought we'd finish early, you had a big break, so it was your fault. So this is where you get into foundationalism and realism, okay? And what I would like you to do is just kind of read through the rest of this on the weekend, if you don't mind. It's not homework, but please do it. And see if you can't go to some websites and type in the word foundationalism and realism and see if you can't figure out some things there. So I'd recommend you do that. And go back to last week's class where we had talked about foundationalism that emphasizes obtaining true and justified beliefs by claiming that knowledge does not require 100% certainty. So that's the idea with foundationalism and realism. So just kind of peruse through this and do a little research on your own time. Foundationalism and realism is what Christians hold. This is the philosophical foundation of the Christian worldview. This is where it comes from, foundationalism and realism. So please understand what these things are. And when we talk to people, we have to kind of educate them a little bit to help them understand what epistemology is, how to get a good epistemology, presenting them with those things we just talked about, and then showing them what foundationalism and realism are. And that will help guide the discussion past skepticism. And that's the idea. We want to get rid of skepticism as a stumbling block. We want to move into bigger and better things. But in order to do that, we have to be educated on epistemology. All right, any last questions real quick before we close out?